Welcome to the Health Design Podcast. Here's your host, Moyez Jiwa.
As a child in India, Shruti Mitgus was fascinated by genetics. Eventually, her interest led to a PhD in the US. In this podcast, she explains the role that genetics may play in future healthcare. Here to share her expertise is Shruti Mitgus. Shruti, you're very welcome to this call. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you to the Health Design Podcast.
Thank you so much, Moyez. I am truly appreciative of being given this opportunity to chat with you, and I would love to tell you a little bit about myself and how I got interested in what I do.
I have to start here because being an Indian myself, or having Indian origins, I understand that you have Indian origins as well. So let's start the story there. Let's start with Shruti as you would have been as a young child back in India.
I grew up in India for the most part. My parents actually were world travelers. And so for a little while, I also grew up in the Caribbean island of Jamaica, and then went back to India and grew up in India in the capital, New Delhi, had a typical childhood. And from a very early age, I would say, probably about sixth grade, I got exposed to a class in genetics. And right then, I knew this was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a geneticist. And so my love for genetics really blossomed in India in elementary school. And I did my entire schooling in India, went on to do a bachelor's and then a master's in human genetics in Delhi, and then decided I would really like to pursue human genetics research, particularly in the healthcare setting. And so went on to get a graduate degree, my PhD in human genetics, and that took me to University of Maryland in Baltimore. So I often like to say education was really my ticket to being able to get out of India, to be able to expand my career options, and to really get my training in genetics so I could make a difference in patients' lives. And this is going back 20 years ago, where genetics was just a burgeoning field. Like, not very many people had even heard about the genetics of human disease. And so I feel like I got in at the right time where things were being discovered. And I was able to really follow my passion and hopefully make a difference in people's lives.
Talk about what it was about genetics and how you were exposed to that in India.
The way I started out was in school. We had a class, just a biology class in sixth grade, and it exposed us a little bit to genetics. And what I mean by that is we learned the basics, what are chromosomes, what every cell of our body has them. And at the time, that it wasn't in depth at all, but I just found it absolutely fascinating that one could take chromosomes from a mother and a father and jumble them up and end up with a child that is completely unique and is completely different from any other child genetically out there. And I thought that was just the most fascinating thing. And then we started to learn in higher grades, we started to learn, well, sometimes things go wrong when an egg and a sperm fertilize, and that leads to genetic diseases. And we don't quite understand what problems they cause in the gene or the protein, but we're actively studying it so that one day we can fix those genetic problems. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating that we could not only find out what was wrong with our 6 billion bases of DNA that we have, but then do something about it to help patients and perhaps fix their disease. And so, although my early schooling was very basic genetics in elementary school, I think it opened up this world for me, which was unusual and not very many people had heard of it. But I thought it was the neatest thing I had ever heard. And that's what I wanted to do with my life when I grew up.
We know that children are often stimulated at an early age to take an interest in things that ultimately lead to careers that make a major contribution to innovation, particularly in healthcare. From what you remember of that childhood experience, what was it about the way that you were taught this that led you to really focus on taking this particular path in your career?
I think what really drew me, Moez, was the fact that not very much was known about what can cause a genetic disease. And again, bear in mind, this is 20 years ago. We know so much more now. But if I remember correctly, I thought to myself, well, how do these problems arise in the genes? What happens in that very early stages of development in the single cell, two cells, four cells? What happens that can drive such a profound change in a fetus and a child? And if we understand that, not only does that help us gain an understanding of the normal functioning of the human body, but it gives us an idea of what we can do to stop that change from happening that can cause all these deleterious effects down the road. So if I remember correctly, and again, I'm going back many decades, but what drew me to genetics was the fact that we didn't really know very much of what was causing the problem. And that to me was a unique challenge. I didn't think or hear of very many people tackling that problem and really researching it. So I found myself drawn to it really because I found the topic fascinating, but I also found it quite challenging to know what are these genes and what do they do in our bodies and how can we fix them when they're faulty and how will that impact a person who has a genetic disease. So I think that's ultimately what drew me, the challenge of exploring something that hadn't really been explored very much at the time.
When we think about the world as it is today and the things that are making the biggest difference to humanity, we're talking about artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, robotics, genomics, they're changing the way the world is responding in the face of major challenges, climate change, the pandemics, we've had COVID-19, access to healthcare when there are limited resources. We need the children who are currently in elementary school to develop an interest in solving those problems, because within the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we are going to need their innovative abilities to create a future where things seem very bleak at the moment. Now, genomics is an area that is contributing in a very substantial way to the way healthcare is responding to people. We're now able to understand a lot more about the etiology of diseases and how, in fact, there is a scope to prevent some of those diseases and potentially to create new treatments, pharmacogenomics and so on. Talk a little bit about how your career then progressed from the understanding of genomics through to the kind of solutions that you are now offering for some of these conditions.
After I got my PhD, I remained as a bench scientist, a research scientist, and I did research on the molecular genetics of a number of diseases. I started off with cancer, and then I transitioned to neuropsychiatric disorders. And so I studied schizophrenia and bipolar disorder to try to figure out what are the complicated pathways that genes interact with each other within the cell to cause this complicated disease, schizophrenia. And at the time, I was doing research at the National Institutes of Mental Health in Maryland, and I was looking at postmortem brain tissue to see what genes were expressed in the brains of people that had passed away with schizophrenia versus those that hadn't. And there were some remarkable, striking differences between the gene expression patterns within those postmortem brains, but we didn't have a smoking gun. We never found, while I was there at least, we never found that one or two or even 10 genes that we could really pinpoint and say, right, this is what causes schizophrenia, and this is how we either shut off or turn on these genes. And so while I was doing that research, it struck me that one of the biggest problems in rare diseases and genetic diseases in general is this inability to get an accurate diagnosis in a timely manner. And so while I was doing basic research, I decided I really want to pivot to helping people get to a genetic diagnosis quicker. And so I went on to then work for a clinical genetic diagnostic lab that specialized in rare diseases, and I helped set up their testing lab. So at the time, we were doing single gene sequencing to find out if a particular variant or mutation was present. I then helped set up their what's called next generation panel sequencing, where we sequence a bunch of genes together instead of doing them one by one. And even within 5 or 10 years, that is outdated now. We started then doing what's called whole exome sequencing, which is where we sequence the protein coding part of our genome and try to see if we can identify variants or mutations that cause disease. And now with the advent of whole genome sequencing, we can not only sequence the parts that of our genome that create protein, but we can sequence almost all of the rest of our DNA. So if you think about it, our DNA, all of us in humans, we have about 20 to 22,000 genes that code for a protein. But there is a lot more of that DNA that doesn't actually code for a functioning protein, but it obviously has some important function, otherwise it would not be evolutionarily conserved. And so with whole genome sequencing, now we're sequencing almost the entire swath of our genome to be able to identify new variants. And so my career progressed from a basic researcher to understanding the molecular etiology of diseases to then helping people identify the variants that they had in their genes and how that could help them get to a clinical diagnosis quicker than the usual 6 to 8 years that it can take for a rare disease patient to get a diagnosis. And you're completely right, Moyes, that genomics has revolutionized not just how we identify genes and variants within those genes that cause disease, but have now opened up a whole field where we can use those genes that we've identified as potential targets for therapeutic intervention, where we can either block genes that are faulty in function or switch on genes that are not being switched on at the correct time. So in my own lifetime, I've seen a huge explosion in the kind of things we can do with genomics and how it's helping people.
The Health Design Podcast is hosted by the Journal of Health Design, in alliance with Unfixed Media and Metal Health.
I want to talk a little bit about the enormous potential that you have described and to express a little bit of frustration as a clinician that we are not currently there, that we still have patients who do not have their tumors sequenced, who do not have genomic expertise deployed to make a diagnosis or indeed to tailor treatment. How far away is this?
I would like to be optimistic and say it's not too far away. However, there are a lot of challenges. And I think one of the things that we need to address really, which is what I'm currently doing as well, is physician and provider education. And so really helping the next generation of physicians, as well as current physicians who are practicing, to really be informed of cutting edge genomics and how this can help their patients not just get an accurate diagnosis, but help them in a potential treatment plan. And one of the biggest stumbling blocks is we just don't do a good job, at least in the United States, in my opinion, of really training physicians on the potential of genomics, why it's exceedingly important to advocate for a patient getting clinical diagnostic testing, whole genome sequencing, tumor marker expression studies and things of that nature. And this isn't to say that physicians are ill-informed. I don't think they are given very much time and opportunity to be really trained in the rapidly evolving landscape that is genomics. And so I think one of the things that we really need to do is increase provider education. And so while I'm optimistic that we're not terribly far away from really using the power of genomics to help a wider array of patients, I think there are still a lot of stumbling blocks, provider education being one of them. Another thing that I find when I talk to patients in my patient advocacy roles is just the lack of access to genetic diagnostics. If you think about it, people in the developed world are having a hard time accessing genetics. And so that problem is compounded in the developing world where resources are not that easy to come by. There's also a huge shortage of genetics providers. So the workforce development has to get more robust. I was reading an article the other day which talked about the average time to see a genetic counselor, and I'm pretty sure it was in Australia, was 2 to 3 years from the time that an appointment was sought. And so when you think about it, if you have someone who is desperate for an answer to their disease, doesn't even know the name of their disease because they're waiting for genetic testing to confirm a diagnosis, waiting 2 or 3 years to see a genetic counselor who can explain the symptoms of their disease, that is unacceptable. And that's a huge stumbling block to accessing genetic-based care. So to answer your question, I think I'm optimistic, but I do see a lot more challenges that we need to address before genomics-based care is standard practice, particularly in rare disease.
One of the issues that we have currently in healthcare is an aging population with multimorbidity, with many complex conditions, so that 1 in 4 people will be at high risk of having all of those conditions. The cost of that healthcare is enormous, so that in order to provide good healthcare, governments will almost be at the point of becoming bankrupt. However, on your white horse, you come with genomics and the potential to actually treat things much, much more effectively and potentially much more cost effectively with better outcomes for the patient. So I do wonder whether, in fact, alongside your physician, you should be potentially consulting a genetics counselor or genetics expert as part of a team, rather than expect the physician to have the expertise in the way that you've described in terms of the education of the physician. I do wonder whether we have now created a new role in healthcare.
We've talked extensively at my work at Global Genes about the possibility of having this comprehensive care team that not only helps with the physician, the team, and the actual helps with the disease state, but you have this comprehensive care team that, as you suggested, includes geneticists and genetic counselors that can get to a diagnosis quicker. And so to address a little bit about the economic burden governments face, as you said, with an aging population, but even with a younger population, if the average time to a diagnosis can be 6 to 8 years for a rare disease, you can imagine the number of healthcare providers a person has seen, specialists a person has seen, the numerous non-genetic tests that have been ordered, and that is all an economic burden on the system. So I would suggest that quicker diagnosis through earlier access to whole genome sequencing should be really a frontline scenario where a patient gets that test up front, so that we cut down on the additional time and cost it takes for a patient to be hunting down their diagnosis once they've gone through a litany of tests and have seen an average of 10 specialists and providers. I think that setup of a comprehensive team, as you mentioned, is critical, and it's also going to combat the rising costs of healthcare. And I also wanted to say, at least here in the US, we really have to push for health insurance companies to be covering whole genome sequencing for patients. Right now, there are about 2 main providers that are starting to cover whole genome sequencing, but we have to make it standard of care, at least for rare disease, if not for all diseases, because like I said, down the road, it cuts back on stress and anxiety and cost and the time it takes to get that diagnosis. And so the economic burden of health, of rare disease, particularly accessing genetics, is huge. And if we bring in this model of having a genetics team as part of your regular care team, I think that's going to make a huge difference. And I also want to really quickly touch upon the fact that if we have a comprehensive team and we have a health insurance industry that covers whole genome sequencing for patients, this is also going to be a huge step towards increasing access to genomics and genetics for patients that have never even heard of genetics, or for that patient that is out in rural America that has to drive 2 hours to a center of excellence to get basic care, let alone genetics clinic, or to the immigrant who doesn't speak the language and perhaps is here without papers or is undocumented, but is still entitled to getting a correct diagnosis and treatment. So I think if we consider a holistic approach of care, which includes a geneticist and a genetic counselor, it's going to go a long way in reducing the economic burden, but also increasing health equity among the underserved communities.
The Journal of Health Design, fostering collaboration, amplifying the voice of health advocates, growing a network to improve outcomes in healthcare.
I want to explore with you one other issue which may be troubling some of our listeners. Inasmuch as it is now possible, as you say, to identify faulty genes and to predict the outcome for patients. This patient's going to get breast cancer, that patient's going to get dementia, the other patient's going to get schizophrenia, and so on, or may get in time, given the conditions. That might worry some people, because your health insurance company will then be aware, even as they provide you with insurance, that you are at risk of these things. And that potentially could lead to further inequity, in that those people who have got a genetic marker for a condition may find the cost of healthcare to them is increased from the get-go.
And it's actually a hindrance to a lot of people to access genetic testing. I've spoken to people who've actually said, I don't want my genes tested. What if it turns up that I do have a risk for X, Y, and Z condition? I don't want my health insurance premiums to skyrocket because now I have maybe considered a pre-existing condition. And to that, I just want to say that at least here in the US, there are some legislative laws that have been passed that prevent discrimination for a genetic test. So employers particularly cannot discriminate if they come to realize that someone is a carrier for a particular disease, and so is health insurance. However, that law is not comprehensive. It's called GINA, the Genomic Non-Discrimination Act. It is not comprehensive, and it doesn't cover particularly things like people wanting to get life insurance, which can have a much higher premium if you have a genetic risk factor already identified. So while there still needs to be a lot of work done to prevent discrimination, there are some laws on the books, and those that are involved in what's called genetic advocacy or policy advocacy are actively lobbying our lawmakers to make these anti-discrimination laws cover a much larger range that can then put people's fears of their own data being used against them at bay. We're not there yet, for sure we're not there yet. But again, I think with policy advocacy as well as education, we could make a dent in letting the fears of being discriminated against go by. I also wanted to really quickly touch upon the fact that many people don't realize that the way we classify genetic variants, there's a whole science to it. And I used to be a variant classification scientist, so I have a little bit of authority to speak on this. The way we classify variants as pathogenic or disease-causing or benign, not disease-causing, is dependent on the amount of evidence we have, scientific evidence we have for a particular variant. So just because a variant currently is classified as a variant that it has no significance currently because we don't have enough data on it, does not mean the classification will not change in the future as more studies come out and as more research is done and we know more about that gene. And the reason I bring that up is there are many variants or mutations, as people like to think of them, that currently might be classified as pathogenic. But as more data comes out and more people are researched and we have additional robust data on that variant, that classification of pathogenic may get downgraded to variant of unknown significance, or even likely benign variant. And the reason I bring this up is because I want to point out that one's risk for a particular genetic condition is not 100% set in stone if one carries a particular variant. There is some leeway for a number of variants, just depending on how much research we end up having on a particular variant. So I just want people to realize, even though they're a carrier for a variant that is currently classified as potentially causing disease, there is a lot more that affects the functioning and the timeliness of when a gene is expressed. And it is not 100% guaranteed that if you have a risk factor for a disease, you will be getting that disease in the future, guaranteed. I want people to walk away knowing there are a lot more factors, what we geneticists call epigenetic factors, which could be environmental influences, stressors, things in your diet that can switch on and off disease. So if we look at disease risk more holistically, there is a lot more that goes on to having a disease that may or may not be entirely hardwired into our DNA.
I would echo that as a clinician working in the current environment, in that we know almost by default as family physicians, knowing the families, that someone is at risk of diabetes or heart disease or cancer or whatever it happens to be. And that's where it comes to advising those patients about lifestyle and other factors that may in fact play into their genetic makeup. Now, we wouldn't be able to identify, most of us, the genes that are responsible. However, we know that certain lifestyle choices will augment the risk, notwithstanding what we don't know. We know that there is a shadow, but we also know that it is possible to prevent that by making different choices. I'm also very pleased to hear you talk about the law and the policy around the protection of privacy, because clearly we also need experts in those areas in order to protect people from the unintended consequences of having your genes identified and the risk factors identified. And so it is also a case that we need expertise in multiple fields in order to progress. And certainly genomics of itself isn't necessarily, or artificial intelligence for that matter, isn't necessarily going to deliver promise unless we also increase our understanding of the ethics around the deployment of those technologies.
I do want to underscore how important it is to talk about the ethics of genetic manipulation, be it for treating disease or altering health outcome. We certainly don't want to play God, where we are tinkering with our genes to prevent a certain outcome, but we end up causing other downstream or even upstream effects that we're not aware of. And this also comes into play when we're talking about the newer therapies that are being developed using genomics. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of gene therapy that is really cutting edge, and it's a way for us to really target a particular gene and a particular variant and either switch it on or switch it off depending on what the defect is. And I'm sure people have heard a lot about things like CRISPR, which is the technology that is able to really pinpoint the variant and sort of snip it out of our genomes. I just want to highlight that these kind of technologies, and certainly down the road, downstream technologies that will certainly come after this, they are great tools to be used to prevent or treat rare diseases and genetic diseases in general. But we have to, hand in hand, have to have an ethical conversation about what is the limit to which we can alter the genome, and all in while keeping the patient confidentiality and the patient outcomes as our gauge. And so there has been work done by the Human Genetic Societies and American College of Medical Genetics and various scientists that really ponder, just because we can, does it mean we should? And what ethical dilemmas would either acting upon a treatment that is based on gene therapy, or withholding that treatment, what dilemmas would that raise, particularly for a patient group that is desperate for a treatment? Are we not cognizant of the fact that they might not have all the information before they embark on gene therapy? Or conversely, are we withholding gene therapy when it would be useful for a patient? And so I just want to underscore the ethics of genetics and pharmacogenetics and gene therapy are a huge component of patient care and need to also be at the forefront, and a candid upfront discussion with patient needs to be had, keeping ethical guidelines in mind.
As you were talking, I was reflecting on three things. Firstly, the enormous value that has been generated by nurturing your curiosity as a child, as is happening around the world in classrooms, in elementary school. We are nurturing tomorrow's leaders. Secondly, the enormous contribution that migrants make around the world. You are from India, you've gone to the United States, and here you are talking eloquently about things that are absolutely current to the care of people in the US, but also around the world. And like you, I share the optimism of solving the world's challenges, challenges that we face as humanity, the challenges that have become so poignant in these last few years with the pandemic, with the rise in the aging population and multimorbidity, and the hope that tomorrow we will be able to do so much better because of all that humanity has contributed in the way that we've described. Thank you so much for joining me on the Health Design Podcast. I've been honored to spend the time with you, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you so much, Moez. It was indeed a pleasure. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk to you, and I hope your listeners get some value from some of the thoughts that I've shared. Thank you.
The Health Design Podcast, serving patient and physician advocates. Visit us at journalofhealthdesign.com.